through the floor. Bosch kept his gun on the doorway to the vault, waiting for anybody else, but there was nothing, only the sound of Clark and Avery gagging and moaning on the floor to his left. Bosch stood up, but kept the gun trained on the vault. Eleanor climbed into the room then, her Beretta in hand. In marksman crouches, Bosch and Wish approached the vault from either side of the door. There was a light control next to the computer keypad on the steel wall right of the door. Bosch hit the switch, and the interior vault was flooded with light. He nodded to her, and Wish went in first. Then he followed. It was empty. Bosch came out and quickly went to Clark and Avery, who were still tangled on the floor. Avery was saying,
"Dear God, dear God."
Clark had both hands clamped to his own throat and was gasping for air, his face turning so red that for one bizarre moment it looked to Bosch as if he were strangling himself. He was lying across Avery's midsection, and his blood was over both of them.
"Eleanor!"
Bosch shouted.
"Get back up in ambulances! Tell SWAT that they're coming! At least two automatic weapons!"
He pulled Clark off Avery, and by grabbing the shoulders of his jacket, dragged him out of the line of fire from the vault. The IAD detective had taken a round in the lower neck. Blood was seeping from between his fingers, and there were small, blood-tinted bubbles at the corners of his mouth. He had blood in his chest cavity. He was shaking and going into shock. He was dying. Harry turned back to Avery, who had blood on his chest and neck, and a brownish-yellow piece of wet sponge on his cheek, a piece of Lewis's brain.
"Avery, you hit?"
"Yes, I don't know,"
he managed in a strangled voice. Bosch knelt next to him and quickly scanned his body and bloody clothes. He wasn't hit, and Harry told him so. Bosch went back to where the double-glazed window had been and looked down at Lewis on his back on the sidewalk. He was dead. The bullets, having caught him in a rising arc, had stitched their way up his body. There were entry wounds on his right hip, stomach, left chest, and left of center of his forehead. He had been dead before he hit the glass. His eyes were open, staring at nothing. Wish came in from the lobby then.
"Back up on the way," she said.
Her face was red and she was breathing almost as hard as Avery. She seemed barely in control of the movement of her eyes, which flitted about the room.
"When backup gets here," Bosch said, "tell them if they go into the tunnels that there's an officer friendly down there. I want you to tell your SWAT people that, too."
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm going down. I hit one. I don't know how bad. It was Franklin. Another went down ahead of him, Delgado. But I want the good guys to know I'm down there. Tell them I'm in a suit. The two I chased down there were in black fatigues."
He opened his gun and took out the three spent cartridges and reloaded with bullets from his pocket. A siren was sounding in the distance. He heard a sharp pounding and looked through the glass wall in the lobby to see Hanlon pounding the heel of his gun on the glass front door. From that angle, the FBI agent could not see that the glass wall of the vault room had been shattered. Bosch motioned him to come around.
"Wait a minute," Wish said. "You can't do this, Harry. They have automatic weapons. Wait till the backup is here, and we come up with a plan."
He moved to the vault door, saying, "They already have a head start. I gotta go. Make sure you tell them I'm down there."
He stepped past her into the vault, hitting the light switch as he went. He looked over the edge of the blast hole. The drop was about 8 feet. There were chunks of broken concrete and rebar at the bottom. He could see blood in the rubble and a flashlight. There was too much light. If they were waiting down there for him, he would be a sitting duck. He backed out and around behind the vault door. He put his shoulder against it and slowly began to push the huge slab of steel closed. Bosch could hear several sirens approaching now. Looking out into the street, he saw an ambulance and two police cars coming down Wilshire. The unmarked car with Hauk in it screeched to a halt in front, and he came out with handgun drawn. The door was halfway closed and finally moving under its own force. Bosch slipped around it and back into the vault. He stood there over the blast hole as the door slowly closed and the light dimmed. He realized he had poised at such a moment many times before. It was always at the edge, at the entrance, that the moment was most thrilling and frightening to him. He would be at his most vulnerable at the moment he dropped into the hole. If Franklin or Delgado was down there waiting for him, they had him.
"Harry!"
he heard Wish call to him, though he couldn't understand how her voice made it through the now paper-thin opening.
"Harry, be careful! There may be more than two!"
Her voice echoed in the steel room. He looked down into the hole and got his bearings. When he heard the vault door clink shut, and there was only blackness. He jumped. As he came down in the rubble, Bosch crouched and fired a shot from his Smith & Wesson into the blackness and then hurled himself flat against the bottom of a tunnel. It was a war trick. Shoot before they shoot you. But nobody was waiting for him. There was no return fire, no sound, except the faraway sound of running footsteps on the marble floor above and outside the vault. He realized he should have warned Eleanor, told her the first shot would be his. He held his lighter out away from his body and snapped it on. Another war trick. Then he picked up the flashlight, turned it on, and looked around. He saw that he had fired his shot into a dead end. The tunnel the thieves had dug to the vault went the other way. West, not east, as they had thought when they looked over the blueprints the night before. That meant they had not come from the storm line Gearson had guessed they would. Not from Wilshire, but maybe Olympic or Pico to the south, or Santa Monica to the north. Bosch realized that the DWP man and all the rest of the agents and cops had been skillfully led astray by Rourke. Nothing would be as they had planned or thought. Harry was on his own. He focused the beam down the tunnel's black throat. It sloped down and then up, giving him only about 30 feet of visibility. The tunnel went west. The SWAT team was waiting to the south and east. They were waiting for nobody. Holding the flashlight off to the right, away from his body, he began to crawl down the passageway. The tunnel was no taller than 3.5 feet, top to bottom, and maybe 3 feet wide. He moved slowly, holding his gun in the same hand he used to crawl with. There was the smell of cordite in the air, and bluish smoke hung in the beam of the flashlight. Purple haze, Bosch thought. He felt himself perspiring freely from the heat and the fear. Every 10 feet he stopped to wipe sweat out of his eyes with the sleeve of his jacket. He didn't take the jacket off because he didn't want to differ from the description given to the people who would follow him in. He didn't want to be killed by friendly fire. The tunnel alternately curved left and then right for 50 yards, causing Bosch to become confused about his direction. At one point, it dipped below a utility pipeline, and at times he could hear the rumble of traffic, making the tunnel sound like it was breathing. Every 30 feet burned a candle placed in a notch dug into the tunnel wall. In the sandy, chunky rubble at the bottom of the tunnel, he looked for tripwires, but found a trail of blood. After a few minutes of slow travel, he turned the flashlight off and sank back on his calves to rest and try to control the sound of his breathing. But he could not seem to get enough air into his lungs. He closed his eyes for a few moments, and when he opened them, he realized there was a pale light coming from the curve ahead. The light was too steady to be from a candle. He started moving slowly, keeping the flashlight off. When he made his way around the bend, the tunnel widened. It was a room, tall enough to stand in and wide enough to live in, he thought, during the dig. The light came from a kerosene lantern sitting on top of an igloo cooler in the corner of the underground room. There were also 2 bedrolls and a portable Coleman gas stove. There was a portable chemical toilet. He saw 2 gas masks and also 2 backpacks with food and equipment in them, and there were plastic bags full of trash. It was the camp room, like the one Eleanor had assumed was used during the dig into the Westland vault. Bosch looked at all the equipment and thought of Eleanor's warning about there possibly being more than 2, but she had been wrong. Just 2 of everything. The tunnel continued on the other side of the camp room, where there was another 3-foot-wide hole. Bosch turned the lantern flame off so he wouldn't be backlit and crawled into the passageway. There were no candles in the walls here. He used the flashlight intermittently, turning it on to get his bearings and then crawling a short distance in the dark. Occasionally, he stopped, held his breath, and listened. But the sound of traffic seemed farther away, and he heard nothing else. About 50 feet past the camp room, the tunnel reached a dead end, but Bosch saw a circular outline on the floor. It was a plywood circle covered with a layer of dirt. 20 years earlier, he would have called it a rat hole. He backed away, crouched down, and studied the circle. He saw no indication it was a trap. In fact, he did not expect one. If the tunnelers had rigged the opening, it would have been to guard against entry, not exit. The explosives would be on this side of the circle. Nevertheless, he took his keychain knife out and carefully ran its edge around the circle, then lifted it up a half inch. He pointed the light into the crack and saw no wires or attachments to the underside of the plywood. He then flipped it up. There were no shots. He crawled to the edge of the hole and saw another tunnel below. He dropped his arm and the flashlight through the hole and flicked on the beam. He swept it around and braced for the inevitable gunfire. Again, none came. He saw that the lower passageway was perfectly round. It was smooth concrete with black algae and a trickle of water at the bottom of its curve. It was a stormwater drainage culvert. He dropped through the hole and immediately lost his footing on the slime and slipped onto his back. He propped himself up and with the flashlight began looking for a trail in the black slime. There was no blood, but in the algae there were scrape marks that could have been made with shoes digging for purchase. The trickle of water moved in the same direction as the scrape marks. Bosch went that way. By now he had lost his sense of direction, but he believed that he was heading north. He turned off the beam and moved slowly for 20 feet before flicking it on again. When he did so, he saw that the trail was confirmed. A smeared handprint of blood was at about 3 o'clock on the curved wall of the pipe. 2 feet farther, and at 5 o'clock there was another. Franklin was losing blood and strength quickly, he guessed. He had stopped here to check the wound. He would not be too much further ahead. Slowly, trying to lower the noise of his breathing, Bosch moved forward. The pipe smelled like a wet towel, and the air was damp enough to put a film on his skin. The sound of traffic rumbled from somewhere nearby. There was the sound of sirens. He felt the pipe was on a gradual downward slope that kept the trickle of water moving. He was going deeper underground. There were cuts on his knees that bled and stung as he slipped and scraped along the bottom. After maybe 100 feet, Bosch stopped and put on the beam, still holding it out to the side of his body and ready with the gun in his other hand. There was more blood on the curving wall ahead. When he switched off the flashlight, he noticed that the darkness changed farther ahead. There was light with a gray dawn quality to it. He could tell that the pipeline ended, or rather connected with a passageway where there was dim light. He realized then that he could hear water. A lot of water, compared to what was running between his knees. It sounded like there was a river channel up ahead. He moved slowly and quietly to the edge of the dim light. The pipeline he crouched in was a porthole on the side of a long hallway. He was in the tributary. Across the floor of the huge hallway, silvery black water moved. It was an underground canal. Looking at it, Bosch could not tell if the water was 3 inches or 3 feet deep. Squatting at the edge, he first listened for sounds other than lapping water. Hearing nothing, he slowly extended his upper body forward to look down the hallway. The water was flowing to his left. He first looked that way and could see the dim outline of the concrete passageway curving gradually to the right. There was shadowy light filtering down at intervals from holes in the ceiling. He guessed that this light came from the drain holes drilled in manholes 30 feet above. This was a main line, as Ed Gearson would say. Which one it was, Bosch didn't know and no longer cared. There was no blueprint for him to follow, to tell him what to do. He turned to look upstream and immediately pulled his head back into his pipe like a turtle. There was a dark form against the inside wall of the passage, and Bosch had seen 2 orange eyes glowing in the darkness, looking right at him. Bosch didn't move and barely breathed for a whole minute. Stinging sweat dripped into his eyes. He closed them, but heard nothing but the sound of the black water. Then slowly he moved back to the edge until he could see the dark form again. It hadn't moved. 2 eyes, like the alien eyes of someone who looks into the flash in a snapshot, stared back at Bosch. He edged the flashlight around the corner and hit the switch. In the beam, he saw Franklin slumped against the wall. His M16 was strapped around his chest, but his hands had fallen away from it into the water. The end of the barrel dipped to the water also. Franklin wore a mask that Bosch took a few seconds to realize was not a mask. He wore NVGs, night vision goggles.
"Franklin!" It's over, Bosch called. I'm police. Give it up.
There was no reply, and Bosch didn't expect one. He glanced up and down the main line one more time, and then jumped down into the water. The water just covered his ankles. He kept his gun and the light on the still figure, but didn't believe he would need the weapon. Franklin was dead. Bosch saw that blood still seeped from a chest wound and down the front of his black T-shirt. Then it mixed into the water and was carried away. Bosch checked the man's neck for a pulse and found none. He holstered his gun and lifted the M16 over the dead man's head. Then he pulled the night goggles off the corpse and put them on. He looked one way down the long hallway, and then the other. It was like looking at an old black-and-white TV, but the whites and grays had an amber tint. It would take some getting used to, but he could see his way better with the goggles, and he kept them on. Next, he checked the supply pockets on the thighs of Franklin's black fatigue pants. He found a sopping wet package of cigarettes and matches. There was an extra clip of bullets, which Bosch put in his jacket pocket, and a folded piece of wet paper on which blue ink was bleeding through and blurring. He carefully unfolded it and could tell that it had been a hand-drawn map. No names identifying anything, just smeared blue lines. There was a square box near the center which Bosch took to represent the vault. The blue lines were the drainage tunnels. He turned the map around in his hand, but the pattern did not seem familiar. A line running along the front of the box was the heaviest drawn. He figured that might be Wilshire or Olympic. Lines that intersected this were the cross streets. Robertson, Doheny, Rexford, and others. There was a cross-hatching of more lines continuing to the side of the page, then a circle with an X through it. The exit point. Bosch decided the map was useless, for he didn't know where he was or what direction he had taken. He dropped it into the water and watched it float off. In that moment, he decided that he would follow the current. As good a choice as any. Bosch splashed through the water, moving with the current in a direction he thought was west. The black water curled against the wall in orange-tinted eddies. The water was above his ankles and filled his shoes, making his steps plodding and unsteady. He thought about how Rourke had played it so well. It didn't matter if the Jeep and the ATVs had been found down by the freeway. That was all a decoy, a setup. Rourke and his bandits had shown the obvious, then done the opposite. Rourke had talked everybody into believing it while setting the battle plans the night before. The SWAT team was waiting down there with a reception no one would attend. He looked for signs of a trail in the passageway, but found nothing. The water took all chance of that away with it. There were painted markings on the walls, even gang graffiti, but each scribble could have been there for years. He looked at it all, but recognized none as a signal or direction. This time, Hansel and Gretel didn't leave a trail. The traffic sounds grew louder now, and there was more light. Bosch flipped up the NVGs and saw shadowy cones of bluish light filtering down every 100 feet or so from manholes and drains. After a while, he came to an underground intersection, and as the water from his line collided and splashed with water moving in the other channel, Bosch crept along the side wall and slowly looked around the corner. He saw and heard no one. He had no clue as to which way to go. Delgado could have gone in any of 3 different directions. Bosch decided to follow the new passageway to the right, because it would take him, he believed, farther away from the SWAT setup. He had taken no more than 3 steps into the new tunnel when he heard a loud whisper from ahead.
Artie, you gonna make it? Come on, hurry, Artie!
Bosch froze. It came from about 20 yards, dead ahead, but he couldn't see anyone. He knew that it had been the NVGs he wore, the orange eyes, that had prevented him from walking into an ambush. But the cover wouldn't last long. If he got much closer, Delgado would know that he wasn't Franklin.
Artie!
The voice called hoarsely again.
Come on! Coming,
Bosch whispered. He took 1 step forward and felt instinctively that it hadn't worked. Delgado would know. He dove forward, bringing the M16 up as he went down. Bosch saw a whirl of movement ahead and to the left, then saw a muzzle flash. The sound of gunfire was deafening in the concrete tunnel. Bosch returned fire and kept his finger tight on the trigger until he heard the injector go dry of bullets. His ears were ringing, but he could tell that Delgado, or whoever was up there, had stopped also. Bosch heard him snap a new clip into his weapon, then running footsteps on a dry floor. Delgado was moving away in another passageway ahead. Harry jumped up and followed, pulling the empty clip out of his borrowed gun and replacing it with the backup as he went. In 25 yards, he came to a tributary pipeline. It was about 5 feet in diameter, and Bosch had to take a step up to move into it. There was black algae rimming the bottom, but no running water. Lying in the scum was the empty clip from an M16. Bosch had the right tunnel, but he no longer heard Delgado's footsteps. He began moving in the pipe, quickly. There was a slight incline, and in about 30 seconds he reached a lighted junction room 30 feet below a grated drain. On the other side of this room, the pipeline continued. Bosch had no choice but to follow, this time with the pipe running on a gradual decline. He went another 50 yards before he could see that the line he was in emptied into a larger passage, a main line. He could hear water running up ahead. Bosch realized too late that he was moving too fast to stop. As he lost his footing and slid on the algae toward the opening, it became clear to him that he had followed Delgado into a trap. Bosch dug his heels into the black slime in a worthless effort to stop himself. Instead, he went feet first, arms flailing for balance into the new passageway. It seemed odd to him, but he felt the bullet tear into his right shoulder before he heard the gunfire. It felt as though a hook on a rope had swung down from above, embedded in his right shoulder, and then yanked him backward off his feet and down. He let go of the gun and fell what seemed to him to be 100 feet. But of course it wasn't. The floor of the passageway, with its 2 inches of water, came up like a wall of water and hit him in the back of the head. The goggles flew off, and he watched, idly and detached, as sparks arced above him and bullets bit into the wall and ricocheted away. When he came to, it felt like he had been out for hours, but he quickly realized it was only a few seconds. The sound of the gunfire still echoed down the tunnel. He smelled cordite. He heard running steps again. Running away, he thought. He hoped. Bosch rolled in the darkness and water and spread his hands out to find the M16 and the goggles. He gave up after a while and tried to draw his own gun. The holster was empty. He sat up and pushed himself against the wall. He realized his right hand was numb. The bullet had hit him in the ball of the shoulder, and his arm hummed with dull pain from the point of impact down to the dead hand. He could feel blood running under his shirt and down his chest and arm. It was a warm counterpoint to the cool water swirling around his legs and balls. He became aware that he was gasping for air and tried to regulate his intake. He was going into shock, and he knew it. There was nothing he could do. The sound of the steps, the running away, stopped then. Bosch held his breath and listened. Why had he stopped? He was home free. Bosch scissored his legs along the floor of the tunnel, still looking for one of the weapons. There was nothing there, and it was too dark to see where they had fallen. The flashlight was gone as well. There was a voice then, too far away and too muffled to be distinguished or understood, but someone was talking. And then there was a second voice. Two men. Bosch tried to make out what was said, but couldn't. The second voice suddenly grew shrill. Then there was a shot, and then another. Too much time had elapsed between shots, Bosch thought. That wasn't the M16. As he thought about the significance of this, he heard the sound of steps in water again. After a while, he could tell the steps were coming through the darkness toward him. There was nothing hurried about the steps that came through the water toward Bosch. Slow, even, methodical, like a bride coming down the aisle. Bosch sat slumped against the wall and again swished his legs along the watery, slimy floor in hopes of locating one of the weapons. They were gone. He was weak and tired, defenseless. The humming pain in his arm had moved up a notch to a throb. His right hand was still useless, and he was pressing his left against the torn flesh of his shoulder. He was shaking badly now, his body in shock, and he knew he would soon pass into unconsciousness and not wake up. Now Bosch could see the beam of a small light moving toward him in the tunnel. He stared fixedly at it with his mouth dropped open. Some of his muscle controls were already shutting down. In a few moments, the sloshing steps stopped in front of him and the light hung there above his face like a sun. It was just a penlight, but it was still too bright. He couldn't see behind it. Just the same, he knew whose face would be back there, whose hand held the light, and what was in the other.
"Tell me," he said in a hoarse whisper.
He hadn't realized how parched his throat had become.
"That and your little pointer a matched set?"
Rourke lowered the beam until it pointed to the floor. Bosch looked around and saw the M-16 and his own gun side by side in the water next to the opposite wall, too far to reach. He noticed that Rourke, dressed in a black jumpsuit tucked into rubber boots, held another M-16 pointed at him.
"You killed Delgado,"
Bosch said. A statement, not a question. Rourke didn't speak. He hefted the gun in his hand.
"You gonna kill cop now? Have the idea?"
"It's the only way I'll come out of this. The way it will look is Delgado gets you first with this."
He held the M-16 up.
"Then I get him. I come out a hero."
Bosch didn't know whether to say anything about Wish. It would put her in danger, but it might also save his life.
"Forget it, Rourke,"
he finally said.
"Wish knows. I told her. There's a letter in Meadows' file that ties you in. She's probably already told everybody up there. Give it up now and get me some help. It'll go better for you if you get me out of here. I'm going into shock, man."
Bosch wasn't sure, but he thought he saw a slight change in Rourke's face, his eyes. They stayed open, but it was as if they had stopped seeing, as if the only thing he was seeing was what was inside. Then they were back, looking at Bosch without sympathy, just contempt. Bosch braced his heels in the slime and tried to push himself up the wall into a standing position. But he had moved only a few inches when Rourke leaned over and easily pushed him back down.
"Stay there. Don't fucking move. You think I'm going to take you out of here? I figure you cost us 5, maybe 6 million from what Tran had in his box. Had to be that much. But I'll never know now. You fucked up the perfect crime."
"You aren't getting out of here."
Bosch dropped his head until his chin was on his chest. His eyes were rolling up into their lids. He wanted to sleep now, but he was fighting it. He groaned but said nothing.
"You are the only thing left to chance in the whole goddamn plan. And what happens? The one chance something will happen, it does. You're Murphy's fucking law, man, in the flesh."
Bosch managed to look up at Rourke. It was a terrible struggle. After, his good arm fell away from the shoulder wound. There was no more strength left to hold it there.
"What?"
he managed to say.
"What do you mean? Chance?"
"What I mean is coincidence. You getting the call out on Meadows. That wasn't part of the plan, Bosch. You believe that shit? I wonder what the odds are. I mean, Meadows is put in a pipe we knew he had crashed in before. We're hoping maybe he won't be found for a couple of days, and then maybe it takes 2, 3 days for somebody to make the ID off the prints. Meantime, he gets written off as an OD, a no-count. The guy's got a hype card in the files. Why not? But what happens? This kid reports the body right off the fucking bat."
He shook his head. The persecuted man.
"And who gets the call? A dipshit dick who actually knew the fucking stiff and IDs him in about 2 seconds. An asshole buddy from the tunnels of Viet fucking Nam. I don't believe this shit myself." "You messed everything up with that, Bosch. Even your own miserable life." "Hey! Still with me?"
Bosch felt his head raise, the gun barrel under his chin.
Still with me?
Rourke said again, and then he poked the barrel into Bosch's right shoulder. It sent a shock wave of red neon pain searing down his arm and through his chest, right down to his balls. He groaned and gasped for air, then took a slow-motion swing with his left hand at the gun. It wasn't enough. He only got air. He swallowed back vomit and felt beads of sweat running through his damp hair.
"You don't look so good, buddy," Rourke said. "I'm thinking maybe I won't have to do this after all. Maybe my man Delgado did it right with the first shot."
The pain had brought Bosch back. It pulsed through him, leaving him alert, albeit temporarily. He could already feel himself fading. Rourke continued to lean over him, and he looked up and noticed the flaps hanging from the chest and waist of the FBI agent's jumpsuit. Pockets. He was wearing the jumpsuit inside out. Something clicked in Bosch's brain. He remembered Sharkey saying he saw an empty tool belt around the waist of the man who pulled the body into the pipe at the reservoir. That was Rourke. He wore the jumpsuit inside out that night, too, because it said FBI on the back. He didn't want to risk that that would be seen. It was a bit of information that was useless now, but for some reason it pleased Bosch to be able to put it in place in the puzzle.
"What are you smiling at, dead man?" Rourke asked. "Fuck you."
Rourke raised his foot and kicked at Bosch's shoulder, but Bosch was ready for it. He grabbed the heel with his left hand and pushed upward and out. Rourke's other foot gave way on the slick bed of algae and slipped out from under him. He went down on his back with a splash, but he didn't drop the gun as Bosch had hoped. That was it. That was all there was. Bosch made a half-hearted effort to grab the weapon, but Rourke easily peeled his fingers off the barrel and pushed him back against the wall. Bosch leaned to his side and vomited into the water. He felt a new flow of blood coming from his shoulder running down his arm. That had been his play. There was nothing else. Rourke got up out of the water. He moved in close and put the barrel of the gun against Bosch's forehead.
"You know, Meadows used to tell me about all that Black Echo stuff, all that bullshit. Well, Harry, here you are. This is it."
"Why'd he die?"
Bosch whispered.
"Meadows. Why?"
Rourke stepped back and looked up and down the tunnel before speaking.
"You know why. He was a fuck-up over there, he was a fuck-up here. That's why he died."
Rourke seemed to be reviewing a memory in his mind, and he shook his head disgustedly.
"It was all perfect, except for him. He held back the bracelet. Little jade dolphins on gold."
Rourke stared off into the darkness of the tunnel. A wistful look played on his face.
"That's all it took," he said. "See, the plan relied on complete adherence for success. Meadows, God damn it, he didn't do that."
He shook his head, still angry at the dead man, and was quiet. It was at that moment that Bosch thought he could hear the sound of steps somewhere off in the distance. He wasn't sure if he had heard it or if it was what he hoped to hear. He moved his left leg in the water. Not enough to cause Rourke to pull the trigger, but enough to make the water slosh and to cover the sound of the steps, if they were even there.
"He kept the bracelet," Bosch said. "That was it."
"That was enough," Rourke said angrily. "Nothing was to turn up. Don't you see? That was the beauty of the thing. Nothing would turn up. We'd get rid of everything except the diamonds, and those we'd keep until we were done with both jobs. But that fool couldn't wait until the second job was completed. He palms that cheap bracelet and pawns it to score dope. I saw it on the pawn reports. Yeah, after the Westland job, we went to LAPD and asked them to send over their monthly pawn list so we could check them out, too. We started to get him at the bureau. The only reason I made the bracelet and your pawn guys didn't was I was looking for it. The pawn detail has to look for 1,000 things. I only looked for that one thing. I knew somebody had held it back. There was a lot reported stolen from that first vault that wasn't in the shit we took out of there. Insurance scammers. But the dolphin bracelet I knew was legit. That old lady, crying, the story behind it with her husband and all that sentimental value shit, interviewed her myself, and I knew she wasn't scamming, so I knew one of my tunnel people had held the bracelet back. Keep him talking, Bosch thought. He keeps talking, and you'll end up walking. Out of here. Out of here. Someone's coming. My arm's humming. He laughed in his delirium, and that made him vomit again. Rourke just went on. I bet on Meadows right from the start. Once on the needle, you know how that goes. So when the bracelet turned up, he was the first one I went to. Rourke drifted off then, and Bosch made more water noise with his legs. The water now seemed warm to him, and it was the blood that ran down his side that was cold. Rourke finally said, "You know, I really don't know whether to kiss you or kill you, Bosch. You cost us millions on this job. But then again, my share of the first one sure has gone up now that three of my guys are dead. Probably even out in the end." Bosch did not think he could stay awake much longer. He felt tired, helpless, and resigned. The alertness had run out of him. Even now, when he managed to reach his hand up and throw it against his torn shoulder, there was no pain. He couldn't get it back. He lapsed into contemplation of the water moving slowly around his legs. It felt so warm, and he felt so cold. He wanted to lie down and pull it over him like a blanket. He wanted to sleep in it. But from somewhere a voice told him to hang in. He thought of Clark clutching his throat, the blood. He looked at the beam of light in Rourke's hand and tried one more time. "Why so long?" he asked in a voice no louder than a whisper. "All these years. John and Ben. Why now?" "No answer, Bosch. Things just come together sometimes. Like Halley's Comet. It comes around every 72 or whatever years. Things come together. I helped them bring their diamonds across. Set the whole thing up for them. I was paid well and never thought otherwise. And then one day, the seed planted all those years ago came out of the ground, man. It was there for the taking, and man, we took it. I took it. That's why now." A gloating smile played across Rourke's face. He brought the muzzle of the weapon back to a point in front of Bosch's face. All Bosch could do was watch. "I'm out of time, Bosch, and so are you." Rourke braced the gun with both hands and spread his feet to the width of his shoulders. At that final moment, Bosch closed his eyes. He cleared his mind of all thought but of the water. So warm, like a blanket. He heard two gunshots, echoing like thunder through the concrete tunnel. He fought to open his eyes and saw Rourke leaning against the other wall, both his hands up in the air. One held the M16, the other the penlight. The gun dropped and clattered into the water, then the penlight. It bobbed on the surface, its bulbs still on. It cast a swirling pattern on the roof and walls of the tunnel as it slowly moved away with the current. Rourke never said a word. He slowly sagged down the wall, staring off to his right, the direction Bosch thought the shots had come from, and leaving a smear of blood that followed him down. In the dimming light, Bosch could see surprise on his face, and then a look of resolve in his eyes. Pretty soon, he sat like Bosch against the wall, the water moving around his legs, his dead eyes no longer staring at anything. Things went out of focus for Bosch then. He wanted to ask a question, but couldn't form the words. There was another light in the tunnel, and he thought he heard a voice, a woman's voice, telling him everything was okay. Then he thought he saw Eleanor Wish's face floating in and out of focus, and then it sank away into inky blackness.
That blackness was finally all he saw. Part 8. Sunday, May 27th. Bosch dreamed of the jungle. Meadows was there, and all the soldiers from Harry's photo album. They stood around the hole at the bottom of a leaf-covered trench. Above them, a gray mist clung to the top of the jungle canopy. The air was still and warm. Bosch took photographs of the other rats with his camera. Meadows was going into the ground, he said. Out of the blue and into the black. He looked at Bosch through the camera and said, "Remember the promise, Hieronymus?"
"Rhymes with anonymous," Bosch said.
But before he could tell him not to go, Meadows promptly jumped feet first into the hole and disappeared. Bosch rushed to the edge and looked down but saw nothing, just darkness like ink. Faces came into focus, then slipped back into the blackness. There was Meadows and Rourke and Lewis and Clark. From behind him, he heard a voice he recognized but couldn't place with a face.
"Harry, come on, man. I need to talk to you."
Then Bosch became aware of a deep pain in his shoulder, throbbing from elbow to neck. Someone was tapping his left hand, lightly patting it. He opened his eyes. It was Jerry Edgar.
"Yeah, that's it," Edgar said. "I don't have much time. This guy on the door says they'll be here any time now. Plus, he's due to go off watch. I wanted to try to talk to you before the brass did. Would have been by yesterday, but this place was crawling with silk. Besides, I heard you were out most of the day, too delirious."
Bosch just stared at him.
"On these things," Edgar said, "I've always heard it's best to say you can't remember a thing. Let them put it whatever way they want. I mean, when you catch around, there's no way they can say you're lying about remembering. The mind shuts down, man, when there is traumatic insult to the body. I've read that."
By now, Bosch realized he was in a hospital room, and he began to look about. He noticed 5 or 6 vases of flowers, and the room smelled putridly sweet. He also noticed he had restraining belts across his chest and waist.
"You're at MLK, Harry. Doctors say you'll be all right. They'll still have some work to do on your arm, though."
Edgar lowered his voice to a whisper.
"I snuck in. Think the nurses have a change of shift or something. Cop on the door, he's over from Wilshire Patrol. Let me in 'cause he's selling and he must have heard that's my gig. I told him I'd take his listing for 2 points if he gave me 5 minutes in here."
Bosch still hadn't spoken. He wasn't sure he could. He felt like he was floating on a layer of air. He had trouble concentrating on Edgar's words. What did he mean about points? And why was he at Martin Luther King, Drew Medical Center near Watts? Last he remembered, he had been in Beverly Hills, in the tunnel. UCLA Med Center or Cedars would have been closer.
"Anyway," Edgar was saying, "I'm just trying to let you know what's going on as much as possible before the Silks get here and try to fuck you over. Rourke is dead. Lewis is dead. Clark is bad. He's on the machine, and I heard they were just keeping him going for parts. As soon as they line up people that need him, they'll pull the plug. How'd you like to end up with that asshole's heart or eyeball or something? Anyway, like I said, you should come out of this all right. Either way, with that arm, you can get your 80%, no questions asked. Line of duty. You're a made man."
He smiled at Bosch, who just looked at him blankly. Harry's throat was dry and cracked when he finally tried to speak.
"MLK?"
It came out a little weak, but okay. Edgar poured a cup of water from a pitcher on the bedside table and handed it to him. Bosch unbuckled the restraints, sat himself up to drink it, and immediately felt a wave of nausea hit him. Edgar didn't notice.
"It's a gun and knife club, man. This is where they take the gangbangers after the drive-bys. No better place to go with a gunshot in the county. Leastwise, those yuppie doctors over at UCLA. They train military doctors here, so they'll be ready for war casualties. They brought you in on a chopper."
"What time is it?"
"It's a little after 7 Sunday morning. You lost the day."
Then Bosch remembered Eleanor. Was she the one in the tunnel at the end? What had happened? Edgar seemed to read him.
Everybody have been doing that lately. Your lady partner is fine. She and you are in the spotlight, man. Heroes. Heroes. Bosch thought about that. After a while, Edgar said, I got a book on out of here. If they know I talked to you first, I'll get shipped out to Newton. Bosch nodded. Most cops wouldn't mind Newton Division. Non-stop action and shooting Newton. But not Jerry Edgar, real estate agent.
Who's coming?
Usual crew, I guess. IAD, officer-involved shooting team. The FBI's in on the act. Bev Hills, too. I think everybody's still figuring out what the fuck happened down there. And they only got you and Wish to tell them. They probably want to make sure you two have the same story. That's why I'm saying, tell them you don't remember Dick. You're shot, man. You are an injured officer, line of duty. It's your right not to remember what happened.
What do you know about what happened?
Huh. The department isn't saying shit. No scut going around on this at all. When I heard it went down, I went out to the scene and Pound was already there. He saw me and ordered me back. Fucking 98, he wouldn't say shit. So I only know what's in the press. The usual load of bullshit. TV last night didn't know shit. The Times this morning doesn't have much either. The department and the bureau, they look like they joined up to make everybody a valiant soldier.
Everybody?
Yeah. Rourke, Lewis, Clark, they all went down in the line of duty.
Wish said that stuff?
No, she's not in the story. I mean, she isn't quoted. I expect they're keeping her kind of under wraps till the investigation is over.
What's the official line?
The Times says the department says Lewis and Clark and you were part of the FBI surveillance at that vault. Now, I know that's a lie, because you'd never let those clowns near one of your operations. Besides, they're IAD. I think the Times knows something about it stinks, too. That Bremer guy you know was calling me yesterday, seeing what I heard, but I didn't talk. My name gets in a paper on this, and I'll get worse than Newton, if there is such a place.
Yeah,
Bosch said. He looked away from his old partner and became immediately depressed. It seemed to make his arm throb all the harder.
Look, Harry, Edgar said after half a minute, I better get out of here. I don't know when they'll be coming, but they will be, man. You take care and do like I told you. Amnesia. Then take the 80% line of duty disability and fuck 'em.
Edgar pointed a finger to his temple and nodded his head. Harry nodded absently, and then Edgar left. Bosch could see a uniformed officer sitting on a chair outside the door. After a while, Bosch picked up the phone that was attached to the railing alongside his bed. He couldn't get a dial tone, so he pushed the nurse call button, and a few minutes later a nurse came in and told him the phone was shut off, as per LAPD orders. He asked for a newspaper, and she shook her head. Same thing. He became even more depressed. He knew that both LAPD and the FBI faced huge public relations problems with what had happened, but he couldn't see how it could be covered up. Too many agencies, too many people. They could never keep a lid on it. Could they be stupid enough to try? He loosened the strap across his chest and tried to sit all the way up. It made him dizzy, and his arms screamed to be left alone. He felt nausea overtake him and reached for a stainless steel pan on the bed table. The feeling subsided, but it jogged loose a memory of being in the tunnel with Rourke the morning before. He began remembering pieces of Rourke's conversation. He tried to fit the new information with what he had already known. Then he wondered about the diamonds, the cash from the Westland job, and whether they had been found.
Where?
As much as he had grown to admire the engineering of the caper, he could not bring himself to admire its maker, Rourke. Bosch felt fatigue overcome him like a cloud crossing the sun. He dropped back against the pillow, and the last thing he thought of before dozing off was what Rourke had said in the tunnel, the part about getting a larger share because Meadows, Franklin, and Delgado were dead. It was then, as he slid into the black jungle hole that Meadows had jumped into before, that Bosch realized the full meaning of what Rourke had said.
The man in the visitor's chair wore an $800 pinstripe suit, gold cufflinks, and an onyx pinky ring. But it was no disguise.
IED, right?
Bosch said, and yawned.
Wake up from a dream to a nightmare.
The man started. He hadn't seen Bosch open his eyes. He stood up and left the hospital room without saying a word. Bosch yawned again and looked around for a clock. There was none. He loosened the chest belt again and tried to sit up. This time he was much better. No dizziness. No sickness. He looked over at the floral arrangements on the windowsill and the bureau. He thought that their number might have grown while he was asleep. He wondered if any of them were from Eleanor. Had she come by to see him? They probably wouldn't let her. In another minute, Pinstripe came back in, carrying a tape recorder and leading a procession that included four other suits. One was Lieutenant Bill Haley, head of the LAPD officer-involved shooting squad, and one was Deputy Chief Irvin Irving, head of IAD. Bosch figured the other two for FBI men.
If I'd known I had so many suits waiting for me, I would have set an alarm, Bosch said. But they didn't give me an alarm clock, or a phone that works, or a TV or a newspaper.
Bosch, you know who I am, Irving said and threw a hand toward the others. And you know Haley. This is Agent Stone and this is Agent Folsom, FBI.
Irving looked at Pinstripe and nodded toward the bed table. The man stepped forward and placed the recorder on the table, put a finger on the record button, and looked back at Irving. Bosch looked at him and said,
You don't rate an introduction?
Pinstripe ignored him, and so did everybody else.
Bosch, I want to do this quickly and without any of your brand of humor, Irving said.
He flexed his massive jaw muscles and nodded at Pinstripe. The recorder was turned on. Irving dryly spoke the date, day, and time. It was 11:30 a.m. Bosch had only been asleep a few hours, but he felt much stronger than when Edgar had visited. Irving then added the names of those present in the room, this time giving a name to Pinstripe. Clifford Galvin, Jr., same name, minus the junior part, as one of the department's other deputy chiefs. Junior was being groomed and doomed, Bosch thought. He was on the fast track, under Irving's wing.
Let's do it from the top, Irving said. Detective Bosch, you start by telling us everything about this deal since the moment you climbed in.
You got a couple of days?
Irving walked over to the recorder and hit the pause button.
Bosch, he said, we all know what a smart guy you are, but we are not going to hear it today. I stopped the tape only this once. If I do it again, I will have your badge in a glass block by Tuesday morning, and that's only because of the holiday tomorrow. And never mind any line of duty pension, I will see you get 80% of nothing.
He was referring to the department practice of forbidding a retiring cop to keep his badge. The chief and the city council didn't like the idea of some of the city's former finest floating around the city with buzzers to show off. Shakedowns, free meals, free flops, it was a scandal they could see coming 100 miles away. So if you wanted to take your badge with you, you could, set nicely in a lucite block with a decorative clock. It was about a foot square, too big to fit in the pocket. Irving nodded, and Junior pushed the button again. Bosch told it like it had been, leaving out nothing and stopping only when Junior needed to turn the tape over. The suits asked him questions from time to time, but mostly just let him tell it. Irving wanted to know what Bosch had dropped from the Malibu Pier. Bosch almost didn't even remember. Nobody took notes. They just watched him tell it. He finally finished the tale an hour and a half after starting. Irving looked at Junior then and nodded. Junior stopped the tape. When they had no more questions, Bosch asked his.
What did you find at Rourke's place?
That's not your business, Irving said.
The hell it isn't. It's part of a murder investigation. Rourke was the murderer. He admitted it to me.
Your investigation has been reassigned.
Bosch said nothing as the anger pushed its way into his throat. He looked around the room and noticed that none of the others, even Junior, would look at him. Irving said,
Now, before I would go around shooting my mouth off about fellow law enforcement officers killed in the line of duty, I would make sure I knew the facts, and I would make sure that I had the evidence supporting those facts. We don't want any rumors being spread about good men.
Bosch couldn't hold back.
You think you people will pull this off? What about your two goons? How are you going to explain that? First they put the bug in my phone, then they blunder into a fucking surveillance and get themselves shot, and you want to make them heroes? Who are you kidding?
Detective Bosch, it already has been explained. That is not your worry. It is also not your role to contradict the public statements of the department or the bureau on this matter. That, Detective, is an order. If you talk to the press about this, it will be the last time you do as a Los Angeles police detective. Now it was Bosch who could not look at them. He stared at the flowers on the table and said, "Then why the tape, the statement, all the suits here with you? What's the point when you don't want to know the truth?" "We want the truth, Detective. You are confusing that with what we choose to tell the public. But out of the public eye, I guarantee, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation guarantees, that we will complete your investigation and take appropriate action where fitting."
That's pathetic. "And so are you, Detective, so are you."
Irving leaned over the bed with his face close enough that Bosch could smell his sour breath. "This is one of those rare times when you hold your future in your own hands, Detective Bosch. You do what is right. Maybe you find yourself back at robbery-homicide. Or you can pick up that phone. Yes, I am going to have the nurse turn it on and call your pals at that rag over on Spring Street. But if you do that, you better ask them if there are any career opportunities there for a former homicide detective." The five of them then left, leaving Bosch alone with his anger. He sat up and was ready to take a swing with his good arm at a vase of daisies on the bedside table when the door opened and Irving came back in, alone, no tape recorder. "Detective Bosch, this is unofficial. I told the others I forgot to give you this." He pulled a greeting card out of his coat pocket and propped it upright on the windowsill. On the front was a busty policewoman with her uniform blouse unbuttoned to the navel. She was wrapping her nightstick in her hand impatiently. A bubble from her mouth said, "Get well soon, or..." Bosch would have to read the inside to get the punchline. "I didn't forget. I just wanted to say something private." He stood mute at the foot of the bed until Bosch nodded. "You are good at what you do, Detective Bosch. Anybody knows that. But that doesn't mean you are a good police officer. You refuse to be part of the family, and that's not good. And meantime, you see, I have this department to protect. To me, that's the most important job in the world. And one of the best ways to do that is to control public opinion, keep everybody happy. So if it means putting out a couple of nice press releases and putting on a couple of big funerals with the mayor and the TV cameras and all the brass there, that's what we are going to do. The protection of the department is more important than the fact that two dumb cops made a mistake. Same goes for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. They will grind you up before they publicly flog themselves with Rourke. So what I am telling you is that rule one is you have to go along to get along."
"That's bullshit, and you know it."
"No, I do not know it. Deep down, neither do you. Let me ask you something. Why is it, you think, that Lewis and Clark were pulled back on the investigation of the Dollmaker shooting? Who do you think reined them in?" When Bosch didn't say anything, Irving nodded. "You see, we had to make a decision. Would it be better to see one of our detectives dragged through the papers and brought up on criminal charges, or for him to be quietly demoted and transferred?" He let that hang there a few seconds before continuing. "Another thing. Lewis and Clark came to me last week with the story about what you did to them, cuffing them to that tree. Very brutal, that was. But they were as happy as a couple of high school cheerleaders after an evening with the football team. They had you by the balls and were ready to put the paper in right then. They had me, but I had them. No, that's what I'm telling you. They came to me with this story about the bug in the phone, what you told them. But the thing is, they didn't drop the bug in your phone like you thought. I checked it out. That is what I am telling you. They had you."
"Then who..."
Bosch stopped right there. He knew the answer. "I told them to hold back a few days, to watch, see what happened. Something was going on. Those two men were always hard to bridle when it came to you. They overstepped when they decided to stop that fellow Avery and then told him to take them back to the vault. They paid the price.
What about the FBI? What do they say about the bug?
I don't know, and I'm not asking. If I did, they would say, "What bug?" You know that. Bosch nodded.